the 1970s, this country had a major, major problem with heroin. There were a lot of heroin addicts. They were committing a lot of violent crimes, purse snatchings, carjackings, violence and criminal activity. Drug activity was the number one concern of American citizens. And DEA was born in July of 1973. We had a mandate to go after these guys. And when you look at drug traffickers in the city of New York, Frank Matthews was a major drug trafficker. He always had the African Americans involved in the distribution of drugs throughout the inner cities in the United States. But in the 70s, the advent of civil rights, when African Americans were becoming more prominent in business, the drug dealers wanted to do the same thing. And it just made business sense from their perspective to cut out the middleman, which had been the Italian mafia, and go right to the source and import heroin and control the distribution. And Frank Matthews at that time, I think, was probably under 30 years old, was extremely bright, had good leadership skills, and had convened a meeting of a lot of the top African-American and Hispanic drug dealers in Atlanta, Georgia, 1971. And his goal was to unite and form a family where they cut out the Italian mafia and went right to the source of heroin and brought it in and controlled the distribution. He lived in Todd Hill, Staten Island, which even to this day, in the year 2011-12, is a very high-profile neighborhood. And during that time when Frank was there, Paul Castellano, the boss of the Gambino family, lived there. And also, if you saw him, although he's extremely flashy with the fur coats, the jewelry, the cars, the women and whatnot, he wanted to keep his wife and children separate from that and lived in an exclusive neighborhood in Todd Hill, Staten Island. The mob, the Gambino family, were involved in drugs for a long period of time. DEA spent a lot of time picking off various members of the Gambino. He was a guy that had great leadership skills and knew how to control a product, make distribution all along the East Coast, and control an organization through violence and intimidation. But there were a lot of people, even in the Frank's organization, that were killed and executed in Philadelphia. And I think guns, violence, and death are part and parcel of the drug trade. In the 1970s, we had a heroin problem in the country, and definitely in New York City. And heroin addicts created violence against innocent civilians. So the politicians made a lot of noise, the media focused on that, which forced law enforcement to go after those guys that were dealing heroin. Cocaine, we weren't really aggressively conducting cocaine investigations like that. In hindsight, that may have been a shortcoming of DEA. When you think about New York City in the 70s, it was a place where if you came out at night and in the fall at 6 or 7 o'clock, I mean, you looked over your shoulder 3 or 4 times before you got to the train station or your car. I mean, it was a gangster town. You know, nobody wanted to go to New York City. Now you fast forward now to 2011, 2012, it's the garden spot. You have visitors all around the world, hotel occupancy is high. Neighborhoods that were the threshold of narcotics like Bed-Stuy and Harlem are vibrant, is it? New York City is thriving now, but it's thriving because of the work of those guys in DEA that went toe-to-toe with these guys and put them into federal penitentiaries. Community president, African-American parents, my parents marched with Dr. King, and they realized they were not going to receive the benefit of Dr. King's dream, but that became something they wanted for their children, to be able to go to college, to be educated, and become earners in society. And the drug guys were pushing heroin, so you had kids who their parents had struggled and marched and wanted to make sure that they were extremely successful and to go as far as their talents could take them, suddenly got involved in drug, and the drug was heroin. So it was just destroying the African-American community.
He did go down to Venezuela, Caracas, and he was awaiting the delivery of 60 pounds of heroin. If he got that 60 pounds on the streets, them mixing the drugs with paddles from canoes. 2 million glassine envelopes. He had lactose. It took us an hour to get through the doors. We finally had to break a wall down. That's when we realized, and the bosses realized, that he was not just a street dealer. He was an international trafficker. You're making money in heroin, you're making money in cocaine. Heroin was, of course, the king at the time. But cocaine was profitable also. You could get a pure package and cut it two or three times and make $30,000 each time you cut it. he dealt in heroin, yes. But we assume that they knew about Frank as being a black trafficker, a black Caesar, as you will. He never showed up at fights. Very rarely did he go to the fights out at New York, Madison Square Garden. But he was very low-keyed in his trafficking. Rolando, an astute dealer too, wanted to meet Frank, and Rolando trusted him. She let him have his ways all the time. But Barbara knew the trade. She was the money counter. She was keeping the money. She kept track of all the money he made. He had this penchant for blondes. Befriended one, bought her an apartment, but beat the hell out of her at one time. He had too much coke in him. It was right by the 41st Precinct. There was a stadium motel. He put $4 million on a table at one time. And he bragged about this. And he says, let me see if you can match this. And nobody could at the time. And he bought heroin or cocaine eventually from, I don't know, more than likely from the Italian businessman, because that's who he knew at the time. That was his main supplier at the time. He trusted his own kind, the people that came out of Durham. I went down to Durham on a flight, and a quarter of an ounce at the most from Frank, because he was a good guy. He didn't even have to pay for it. Frank would throw it at him. It got interesting when more murders came in, more murders that Frank had committed or had something to do with. One of them was a state senator from Baltimore. Turk Scott was a senator from Baltimore, and Frank had him killed. Frank didn't trust him. I don't think he was a homeboy, to tell you the truth. We knew that he had a couple of contacts in Baltimore named Brother Carter and Liddy Jones. He also had contacts in Philadelphia through Pop Darby. Harold Rosenbaum turned out to be the man who supplied the 2 million glassine envelopes. We went to see Mr. Callahan, who was a special counsel at the time. We needed subpoenas to further the investigation. He supplied them. He gave them to us. Frank met Cheryl Brown around 1972-73 over here at 96th Street and First Avenue. And it was a smart place to go to. A lot of drug dealers went there. And she was in there. And she was young. She was 18. And he pulled up outside with his white Rolls Royce, and she fell in love with the car and supposedly fell in love with Frank. And from then on in, it was Frank and Cheryl. She was beautiful. She was. She was well-built. She had a beautiful body. Eventually, after Frank became a fugitive, we went out to Boys High School and interviewed him. He didn't want to talk about it. He was distraught over the fact that Cheryl Brown, who got arrested with Frank, the bail was excessive, but it made headlines, and we thanked the judge vociferously.
Standing couple.
The Cheryl Brown's parents were refined, upstanding couple in the community. They definitely were. That Barbara had made arrangements to have this party over in Buttonwood Road. And Jerry Miller called me up and said, come on, I know you live close by, and meet me over there, and we're gonna try to sneak up to the party. We got into the grass, and we started crawling up, and I'm wearing red, white, and blue pants, because I left the party myself, and he's, you know, dressed in his black clothing, as Jerry Miller always did. They were all in the backyard having a party on the deck, and finally, no, Pop Darby spotted us and said, I think there's people out there. She goes, oh, they're just having, they're from the other party. Well, Jerry mounted me. And I had to go along with it, but he made believe he was
gay.
We were on Lenox Avenue one day. There's Frank on Lenox Avenue and 140-something Street. And I started, you know, following. Frank was doing a walk and talk with somebody on the street, and I'm watching the movements of Frank, and I smack right into a car. Frank came over and said, oh, these damn photographers, you know, with damn drivers, honky drivers.
I mean, they may be colorful, they may be glamorous, they may give turkeys on Thanksgiving, they may support a little league baseball team, but they're selling a substance that's going to kill your child or your grandchild. Nicky Barnes went to jail for life. Frank Lucas went to jail for 70 years. Frank Matthews is a fugitive, and if he's still alive, he's still looking over his shoulder. Black power was for equality for African Americans. Black gangsters are committing illegal crimes. They're destroying the community, okay? So, you know, as they say in the street, you don't want to get this thing twisted, okay? You really want to know who the heroes are. And the heroes are, I'd like to say, is my generation, the first generation of agents with DEA, and especially as African-American agents who worked undercover. I mean, that's how you made your bones in the 70s. And they made a decision coming from the same environments as the drug traffickers, first generation maybe to go to college, living in the projects like myself, but made a commitment to join these organizations, which wasn't always applauded, but we realized the value of it, to help the community. Take the drug dealer out so kids can enjoy their neighborhood and become strong citizens and productive citizens. Yeah, I mean, the rumors ran the gamut. I mean, obviously, they didn't think he was going to be in New York because that's where the case was. So he had connections in Venezuela, so he could have been in South America. He got a strong pipeline in other states. I'd say he was definitely smarter than Frank, okay? Frank Lucas, yeah. Definitely. You know, the reports are he controlled the Eastern Seaboard, you know. And so he was definitely a leader at a very young age. Okay, and there probably, you know, were some close calls where maybe we, you know, maybe should have acted a little quicker and we did not get him, okay? But that said, we're always going to be looking for him. Well, I don't want to go into the nature of the investigation, but we've had information periodically. We were looking in different places, in different cities in the U.S., especially on the East Coast. We thought we were getting close at one point and we enlisted the support of a guy by the name of Bender, who did the bus for John List on America's Most Wanted and had a bus made, you know, and it showed it to that new generation of agents that were going to be hitting the streets. And fugitives, you know, get caught for a variety of reasons, okay? They anger somebody, so there's people are motivated to turn them in. It could be money. It could be somebody that has a pending case and they realize this is the information that'll make that case go away. So it's a variety of reasons why we in law enforcement get information. Money is one of them. Sometimes we'll get information that has nothing to do with money. There's, I mean, the quote, there's honor among thieves. I mean, a lot of these people hate each other, you know. I can tell you the countless times we've arrested a guy and before we got him back to Manhattan, a 45-minute ride, they can't wait to set up the leader of the organization. It was great. We had all sport in the world to do it because you had a cadre of older agents that were around or just recently retired that said, that's great. We'd like to help you. You know, some of these guys can be very vindictive. And your whole goal when you become a fugitive is not to go back to prison. So you want to blend in. You don't want to stand out. Well, I don't want to get into all that because that will lead to where we had the investigation, and we don't have him in custody yet. So suffice to say that we still have people looking. It's an international investigation. We're an international organization, okay? And the major drug guys go everywhere, you know? No, I mean, it could be. I didn't get that information. I mean, people speculate, plastic surgery, maybe dead, but I didn't get that information. People thought that this could have been the guy, and we developed those leads, but obviously it wasn't because we don't have him in custody. Right. If you show into somebody's neighborhood and you're asking something about a criminal, why would people want to talk with you? I mean, you can't protect them if they give you information, so why would they want to talk with you? What would be the point? You know, with law enforcement, we can protect them. Okay, so if a journalist or somebody would say, tell us about this major fugitive who committed a couple of homicides and he's been on the lam for 30-some-odd years, and if he gets caught, you know, who knows what will happen, you know, in the hunt to catch him. Why? What would be the motivation? Why would somebody want to tell you? I mean, it's an old story for them. If they know something, they don't know anything. There's no good side for a civilian to talk to a journalist about a major drug deal. 35 years later, we're still looking for this guy. Like, certain things are okay to talk about, but investigations, especially when they're active, you want to keep those quiet. I think he's alive. I think he's alive somewhere. He made a lot of money, and he's, dialed it down a lot and leading a normal life, a life such as if he was in the witness protection program, not very visible and not very public, you know. Obviously, I thought he was alive because we would have not put the focus, the spotlight back on in Philadelphia and then several years later in New York. So obviously, I think he's alive. Obviously, that was reinforced when the agents and the police officer went out and talked to various people and picked up evidence that we were able to accumulate back then, you know. But he's a very smart guy, and he's going to be difficult to catch, but difficult doesn't mean impossible. Unknown. He could be alive today and pass away of a heart attack tomorrow, so then he beat us, you know.
You heard that.
He could be in South America. He can be in another part of the country. He could be in the South somewhere, you know. If he was arrested today, they would be surprised that this guy had a past back to the 1970s, which was involved in major heroin distribution. They know him as another name, as a guy that's a decent guy, that is always a smile on his face and doesn't seem to have a temper and whatnot, because he's smart enough to realize he's got to dial it down a lot. South America, because he had connections for cocaine in Venezuela. And so obviously he knew people in that part of the world, okay? I would think in the U.S. I would think in the U.S.
Why do you think that would be?
You can blend in easy. It's a system he knows very well. The communities he can go with money and live a middle-class existence. And you can blend in if you obey the rules of the town and the neighborhood and want to become a solid citizen. What he has going in his favor is the generation of people that were uniquely familiar with his investigation are retired, no longer around. I mean, you're talking to me about him. I came on DEA in 1974. Frank Matthews was already a fugitive. Okay, so I wasn't involved in his investigation and arrest. So the major leaders of drug organizations now would love us to spend 80% of our time going after a guy 30 years ago and allow them to get entrenched and build fortunes and whatnot. You're trying to go after people that don't want to get caught, okay? And they have a lot of money and a lot of resources. And they operate in an underworld where people are sympathetic to them. And maybe not as sympathetic for law enforcement.
A Rolls Royce pulled up from Jamaica. And Frank pulled up about 2 minutes behind him. And the guy waved to him, hello. And then Frank went around to the back of his car, took out an unwrapped, marked kilo with his fingerprints on and all, and threw it over to the guy in the car. The guy put it in the trunk of the car. Frank closed his trunk, went down to the garage, and parked his car. That's how ballsy he was. We didn't get the support we really needed. And he said, it's time to take it to Washington. And that's when we formed CENTAC 2. And we were sat down, and we put together this case diligently, and Jerry Miller was smart enough to notify Tony Pohl, and they took it down there, and they formed CENTAC 2. In 1973, Frank made his last appearance in the Eastern District of New York in front of Judge Ray Deary. Judge Travia lowered the bail to $350,000 from $5 million. It was just coming down incrementally. $350,000 was ludicrous for this type of dealer. New York to Texas, and then took another plane from Texas to wherever.
Country,
he left the country, yeah. We learned from an informant that he left Texas. And before he left, this informant at the time, who I'm not going to name, Frank introduced me to the Italian businessman. And I did a 2-kilo deal with them. And it was quality was poor. it was cut so many times, it was hardly a jolt in the street. Skipped and went to Mexico, and from there went to South America. He says, I believe that Frank, the $5 million bail was the highest at the time established for a person in the United States. I think he's alive. And I say this unequivocally because he's a smart person. And he's got the homeboys protecting him, and Marcella protecting him, and Durham, North Carolina protecting him. I think he's alive. There have been many informants, both LCN, La Cosa Nostra types, that supposedly, killed him or had him eliminated because he was a threat to La Cosa Nostra. He was well known as a drug dealer, and he was held in $5 million bail. As many informants as possible, not one of them came forward and told us that they wiped him out, that they did him in. She did leave with them. She went to Texas. We were told by an informant that she went to Texas with them and took a plane from Texas out of there. Whether they had phony passports and he could buy anything, he had the money to buy anything, including a passport for her and him. So he did take her out. He was a wise businessman, and I've stated this before. If he went into business and started his own company, it would have been successful, other than drugs. I know it. McDonald's. He would own 20 McDonald's and open up franchises, and he would know how to operate them. You have to be smart, because one day he called up the plant and he chastised one of his lieutenants who ran the Ponderosa, the plant that we raided, and he said, you got to be careful of the police because they have cat's eyes and they can see in the dark. That's the only time I've been on many wiretap, and that's the truth. We could see in the dark. We have our gear, our special gear, and Frank knew it, and he always gave these hints to his underlings. To make 10,000, 20,000 bags a night, they would work. The drug cutters would work at the Ponderosa, which was 101 East 56th Street at the time. They would work for 24, 36 hours straight. This is a classic. He would have them at the table with no clothes on. And they were cutting up drugs with the deck of cards and filling the glassine envelopes. After all, we seized 2 million glassine envelopes ready to go. $10 dosages. Heroin wasn't king in Philadelphia. Cocaine was. And they had more cocaine addicts than heroin addicts. Pop Darby knew Walter Rosenbaum, and that's the connection. He even took care of the guy who handed you the towels in the men's room. Frank was great. He'd give you a $100 bill for doing nothing, for handing him a towel. Frank went to Vegas a lot, as much as he could. He would take money out and cleanse it and wash it through the casinos. Maybe attend the fight, maybe, but he was more interested in the hookers and the parties that they threw in the rooms. And losing money was part of the money laundering scheme, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'd just like to say one thing of all the questions that you asked and whatnot. He's alive. He's well. He's under medical care maybe at this point in life, but he's alive. And that's it.
What if I told you that the illegal drug business wouldn't be possible without the American government?
Treason against the American people committed by Central Intelligence.
For a meeting with the CIA, and you will have your indictment dismissed in federal court.
The U.S. government cut deals and bestowed favors on brutal dictators, malevolent generals, murderous gangsters in every corner of the globe.
You're getting emotional again.
You might think it was just a conspiracy theory. You'd be wrong.
Drugs were in the black community. Nobody really cared.
All the heroin was coming from Italian sources, Jewish too.
the African American community has quite a debt to what we would consider a criminal enterprise.
You know, only poor people got the time to make moral judgments.
This is black organized crime.
Yes. Yes.
You might think that Timothy Leary's quote, "to tune in, turn on, and drop out with LSD," was meant to change America.
Do you have the feeling of reality when you look at this paper and you hold a pencil in your hand?
No. Yes.
But what if LSD was really part of a secret U.S. government mind control program? Turns out that it was.
I give the CIA a total credit for sponsoring and initiating the entire consciousness movement of the 1960s.
Early 65, I decided that I really wanted to make a lot of LSD and give it away.
International drug trafficking was subordinate to the national security interests of the United States.
American Dope. For the first time, the real story of the global drug trade, told by the undercover agents, kingpins, and prosecutors who were there at the very heart of darkness.